Hey folks, welcome to Unsung. I'm Mark.
I'm Chris. This is the C part
of our REM spectacular. Once it's done, we never have to come back.
Yeah, I mean, they are one of those bands.
Hard going.
Wait a minute. I'll fucking tell you about Hard Going, mate. I've done Rusty for Dave, right? I've done fucking, how many Meshuggah albums was it? And I like Meshuggah.
Yeah.
But that's Hard Going, right? This is not that hard going, right?
It's just a bit bland in places, a lot of places, the first 10 years, for example.
You can still do stuff when REM's on in the background. Have you ever tried to do stuff when Meshuggah's on?
Yeah, nothing you can really do that makes any sense.
Apart from Twitch.
Yeah.
So we're on part C, and we've only just left off Without a Time, which I think is a very skittish, erratic album. As successful as it was, you know, big singles, Shiny Happy People, Fuck Me, Don't Want to Hear It, Michael Stipe doesn't want to hear it, you know, it happened, let's leave it in the past. But other stuff like Country Feedback, Texarkana, that are just fantastic. Half a World Away, we both really like that one.
This could be the saddest dust you've ever seen. Turn to a miracle. I'm alive. My mind is racing.
Just a really interesting change in the band's career. That whole kind of indie jangle punk stuff. I mean, it's only one album away now, but it's starting to feel quite far away, and it was about to change a lot. The band are now very successful. Let's be clear. They are very successful, yet they are also not touring. They are in a position where they could have been doing 18-month arena tours of the globe, and they decided, don't fancy it, mate.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay at home and play 1991, what's that? It's not even PlayStation, what's it? Super Nintendo?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
SNES?
SNES,
aye. Play a wee bit of SNES?
Yeah.
Maybe like Mega Man 4?
Yep, Mega Man 4. But what did they do instead? They wrote another album.
They wrote another fucking album, mate. That's what they did. They wrote a little known record called Automatic for the People.
Another album with an iconic cover.
Iconic cover. You know, one thing about this album, I've seen it in just, oh my God, I'm going to definitely show my age here, right? Because we're going to talk about jewel cases. Mm-hmm. And kids, that's what CDs used to come in. And CDs were plastic discs that had MP3s.
Kids don't listen to our show, mate. Don't worry about it.
thank fuck for that. But they might be in the car and the parent might be making them listen. But anyway, I remember an edition of Automatic for the People where the tray was neon yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And the cover,
I remember that.
The cover was black and white, but then there were others that were just sort of monochrome. And I actually quite liked the neon yellow one. It was pretty cool.
They had aesthetic on point. Yeah. After they got rid of the fact they had no aesthetic.
Yeah. I mean, like those early covers are fairly consistent, but they're just a bit, what's this? You know, a bit like, I mean, they are.
They're all the same colour. They're all kind of beige, like the music. They're all kind of beige.
They do remind me of a certain music fan. He doesn't like things too strong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't want sugar in their coffee. They don't want chilies in their pizza. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They don't want cheese in their pizza. Nah. Let's be honest.
I do want cheese in a pizza. That's not the problem, mate.
But they had a good eye for a catchy image. You know, from Out of Time, which is pretty basic, but just acquired a cultural significance. Even Green, the cover of Green is pretty iconic. And I do think Document is better than the others. But by the time they got to Automatic for the People, like, it was just eye-catching. It was like, there's that fucking album.
That's your major label marketing money right there.
It is, and it's definitely going to continue for the next couple of years as well. But we'll get to that in due course. Automatic for the People, 1992, as you mentioned earlier on, the album that Kurt Cobain said Nirvana had one more album in them and he hoped it would be as good as that in a similar vein.
Can you imagine? It's actually...
I can't... When you hear Unplugged...
That's what I was going to say. Unplugged is like... Yeah. That stands instead as if that obviously as the final Nirvana record, and you got to imagine that, you know, it would have been something close to that.
In saying that though, man, I have to say, and I say this with kindness, please go back and listen to our Incesticide episode, the Nirvana episode, for proof of this. Kurt Cobain was an incredibly fickle guy, and I am not convinced that he would have stuck by that, because I think he might have done it for a while and said, oh, I'm just not feeling this.
He did it with an outro. He did follow through on that. Did say the next record after Nevermind was going to be not commercial, and it wasn't really.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Mm. But that's the thing. I actually kind of get the feeling they would have maybe stuck with that. Mm. I kind of feel like they were really in the groove of like stuff like Milk It and, you know, Scentless Apprentice and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, we'll never know, right?
We'll never know. Yeah.
But I am not entirely convinced that you can take Kurt at his word.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that to be mean. I just mean he was, yeah. He was erratic.
Yeah. And he was a pal of Michael Stipe's at this time.
He was a very good friend of Michael Stipe's. Through Courtney Love, though, I believe, because Courtney and Michael Stipe were good friends, and that's how they got introduced. Automatic for the People is both Peter Buck and Mike Mills' favourite REM record. Interesting bit of trivia. We mentioned Michael Stipe's. He's clearly bisexual, pansexual, however you want to term it. During this period, he had to contend with these constant rumours that he had HIV.
Yeah, because he was so skinny.
But I think it also obviously reflects society's...
Freddie Mercury.
...existing bias.
You know, Freddie Mercury died in 1992, did he?
It must have been close to that, yeah. Maybe 91?
Mm-hmm. Zeitgeist.
It just is what it is. It's society. It's not a conscious decision, is it really? But they still had hang ups about men who were not straight. Mm-hmm. And he looks a bit thin. Maybe he's got AIDS.
Yeah.
So that was a big deal for Michael Stipe at this time. Automatic for the People is named after a restaurant in Georgia.
Mm, nice.
There you go. And John Paul Jones did the strings on it.
Well, that's cool. He was really good at that as well, and Led Zeppelin, he was like
exactly,
really, really
yeah,
good at
and
that.
It's clear that they kind of went for that, and obviously the being on a major label helped. It's seen as a bit of a melancholy step back from the energy of Out of Time. I mean, there are moments in Out of Time that are not particularly energetic, but there are also others that are far too fucking energetic.
Yeah.
At this point as well, as we said, they're not touring. So REM is purely a studio band, really. They were doing live appearances. I think they did an MTV Unplugged, but they were not on the road, and they were not on the road for this album. And this album is 16 million and upwards, mm-hmm. I think, and they were still like, nah, just don't fancy it.
To go back to my point, right, that I made a couple of episodes ago about the fact that were it not for grunge, the trajectory of modern rock music in America would have been REM. Like, the fact that this came out the same year as Nevermind.
Counting Crows says yes.
Yeah, this came out the same year as Nevermind, right? So Nevermind completely fucking smashes this in terms of the amount of records are sold in. Don't get me wrong, this still sold a lot of records.
This actually came out the year, it was after Nevermind.
Yeah, so like, if imagine how many records this would have sold if Nevermind, if grunge didn't exist, yeah. Right? It's like, it would have been way, way more than that, significantly more than that. The kids would have been listening to this.
Yeah, I think so. It maybe wouldn't have had such a daddish vibe. I mean, the thing is, okay, we'll go track by track, right? Because that's the only way to make this case fairly. It is slightly undeserved, the sort of conformity that this album is associated with, I think. Let's start with the first one, Drive, which is fucking sensational music.
This is an old country song.
What if I ride? What if you walk? What if you rock around the clock? Tent, top, tent, top. What if you...
This is beautifully composed, the starts and the stops, the ebb and the flow, yet despite that kind of stuttering sort of momentum, it's incessantly building with each section, and it's lush as well, whilst also being quite tragic.
It's quite forlorn and melancholy.
It's very forlorn, yeah. The key changes are so smooth as to feel like they barely happen, which is a skill, really is a skill. And this was a single, I think, says a lot about the band, because you do not release this song if you're really looking to court pure mainstream success, because it is an obtuse and understated thing. I also want to draw attention as well just to the electrified guitar that just stabs in at 2 minutes.
Hey, kids, shake a leg. Maybe you're crazy in the head, baby.
just out of nowhere, this gentle song has this brilliant guitar refrain that comes in. I just think it's an absolute masterclass in writing. It really does not sound like the REM of Fables of the Reconstruction. It doesn't sound like that. It's something altogether far more sophisticated, and I probably can't overstate the admiration I have for this song in particular. It's properly next level to me.
Yeah.
The second track in it, Try Not to Breathe.
I will try not to breathe. I can hold my head still with my hands at my knees. These eyes are the eyes of the old. Shivering and bold.
A great song. Somewhere within the weird folkiness of the waltz time, you can almost hear the sort of sparkly indie rock song it could have been if they'd written it 5 years prior. Like, if you listen to Try Not to Breathe and imagine it with drums and sort of that arpeggiated clean guitar thing and stuff, it would still work, but it wouldn't be that kind of odd sort of it's quietly trippy. Mm-hmm. It's got an oddness to it. They eschew a solo or a middle eight in favour of a weird saturated thing as well. You know, the feedback. It doesn't have a solo. Yeah, I mean, they're really starting to mess about with effects. They're starting to mess about with the studio quite well. Now, like, let's be clear. You're listening to the Unsung Podcast here. This album is definitely not unsung, but I'm asking you to go with me here. And I'm looking at you, Mark. I'm addressing you.
This is their best record.
Well, certainly half the band thinks so. I'm asking you to go with me here, and I'm asking the audience to go with me here, right? There's a phenomenon at play here where the band seem to have intentionally tried to step away from what made them popular in the record immediately prior, with the likes of Shiny Happy People and with The End of the World as We Know It and all that kind of stuff. Because compare Drive to those songs, you're not trying to get the same crowd with that single. But I think genuinely, via the sheer brilliance of the writing and the production, that this album resonated so much, not just with that sort of early days indie student crowd, but with my ma, with your ma, with everybody's ma. Everybody's ma was going, "What's that, REM? I quite like them." You know, that this album had an appeal that I don't even think was intentional. I really, really don't. I don't think they could have known that it was going to do that. But between them and Scott Litt, they created just something astonishing. I mean, it's easy to forget how normalised and passé these tracks feel in hindsight. It's easy to forget, for example, how much bands like Coldplay have built their castle on this terrain. You know, they rely on this sort of stuff to give context to what they're doing. You know, you look at the majority of these songs in terms of how much the band shunned the expectations of the audience, for starters. Like, the first two tracks in it, the audience would have been like, "The fuck is this? This is not REM." It's not until the third track that they actually give the audience in Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight what they'd kind of been waiting for. And I think that's incredibly bold. I think the fourth track, everybody's going to be shouting, "Everybody hurts though, everybody hurts, cheesy shite."
When you're sure you've had enough of this life, hang on.
First off, it was written by Bill, the drummer in the band, not the main songwriter. Somebody had songwritten all the way through, but not the main songwriter. What I want to blow everybody's mind as well as my own. Everybody Hurts only got to number 29.
Yeah, it's not a pop song.
What the fuck? Yeah. Everybody Hurts is like, what? I mean, it's up there. And like, I mean, if you did like the 100 most famous songs of the 90s, it would be in there.
It's perfect for soundtracks and TV shows.
And it got to number 29.
Yeah,
Could REM have possibly known that Everybody Hurts would become a cultural phenomenon? No fucking way. Look at the songs that had made REM successful at this point, like Shiny Happy Fucking People and The End of the World as We Know It. And then they go and release Everybody Hurts. There's no fucking way they knew that could have become the cultural fucking totem that it actually is.
Yeah.
They'd never recorded or released anything of that Kane prior. It's basically a lullaby, and it could actually have totally bombed. Did it pave the way for decades of maudlin bollocks? Yes, it absolutely did. It absolutely is responsible for so many of the worst, corniest, most bullshit songs of the last 20 years.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's their fault. They didn't know it was going to do what it was going to do. And I think what people really forget in light of that is just that this record's actually pretty varied and pretty strange. I mean, look at like New Orleans instrumental number one. Right in the middle of the album, they do this weird fucking like dreamy thing. It's like a country indie version of The Caretaker or something like that. You've got Star Me Kitten, which is very strange. You've got Sweetness Follows, which is a very strange song. I used to wonder why did you bother distance from one to the other. Listen here, my sister. It's only Monty Got a Raw Deal when they actually start to kick into like what you might call recognisable REM terrain again. Just let go. I saw the ocean be the man. I saw you buried in sand. I think that Monty Got a Raw Deal as well, it could either have been on that Christmas list of great songs that weren't actual singles, or if we tie it in with that conversation of REM overshadowing the quality of some of their album tracks by having these brutally huge singles like Everybody Hurts. Because Monty Got a Raw Deal was just hidden away in between Man in the Moon and, you know, Sidewinder. But it's a fucking excellent song. Really, really, really good song. I think it's one of the definitive REM tracks, actually. If you take it in and of itself, its construction, the kind of minor key that it's in, the fact that it's pessimistic yet kind of buoyant, I think it's a fucking magnificent song. I think Man in the Moon, a wee bit like Sidewinder, is a bit of REM saying to the crowd, hey, here's a bit of what you want, but kind of on steroids given how huge that song became. Clearly it's played to death, so it's kind of hard to be objective about it now.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's kind of unfair to suggest that it's anything other than just a very sincere and well-written 90s pop tune. It's not shit, you know? It's absolutely, completely shagged out, but it's not shit. I don't want to hear it. I certainly don't want to hear it to the end, but it's not shit.
Yeah.
And then say a track like Night Swimming. Photograph on the dashboard, taken years ago. Turned around back so the windshield shows every street light.
I quite like Night Swimming. I've always liked Night Swimming.
It's such an odd song because think about what it actually is. How could they expected that to land as well? Everybody Hurts actually makes maybe more sense than Night Swimming because Night Swimming is just this cascading arpeggiated piano with a very miasmic sort of floaty construction that doesn't really make a lot of sense. And yet, there you go, video, single, famous song. It's a very odd choice and it connected. And I think I'm looking to this to back me up in that case of like, I think with this album, REM were like, all right, let's take a wee bit of a step away from the limelight. We're not going to tour. Let's release a good album of shit that we like that's a bit different. Let's get away from shiny, happy people. And then it goes and becomes absolutely even more enormous. And they're like, oh, for fuck's sake. Well, that didn't work. And so then they were like, right, okay, everybody wants us to do strummy fucking weepy shit. Let's do a glam rock record. Q 1994 and Monster.
So Monster.
So Monster kicks your back doors in, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Like a big fuzzy rock record, finally.
That didn't really connect to me, to be honest.
Well, let me put you in.
But it is a glam rock record, though.
It's a glam rock record. This is a different REM. Also, this debuted at number one and was pretty well received. Mm-hmm. Do you know that this album, I don't know if it was the CD version, but certainly the vinyl version, was released with a floppy disk that contained bonus content.
Wow. What was the bonus content?
Fuck knows, man. Like, it would be 8-bit, so...
Yeah.
24 pixels of Michael Stipe's pink face. Maybe. I don't know. He was bald at this point, so it'd probably be easier to render. It was one of the first to try and do that, the bonus content thing, and then obviously that led on to DVDs and things like that. And what was the enhanced CDs?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was another one, wasn't it? And Laserdiscs.
Put them in your PC. Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the story behind Monster is that Bill Berry, the drummer, and the man responsible for Everybody Hurts, and thus responsible for all the shit that tried to sound like Everybody Hurts, mm-hmm. Bill Berry was apparently keen to tour again, but to tour again, he was determined that they were going to record a rocking record, so it was actually fun to tour, so they weren't going up on stage with too many songs.
Everybody Hurts, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Too many pianos. Firstly, I find this entire record very, very warm, and that starts with the cover, because the cover of this record is iconic.
It is.
The big, out-of-focus, fuzzy monster face on a bright orange background with a blue logo. Just, I mean, it looks so random, but yet, it is one of those brilliant things. I mean, you're right, they've got a better marketing department working with them here that just knows. It's like, hey, believe me, this is going to work. And it fucking works. Mm-hmm. Like, it really contributes to your mental image, your impression, your lasting impression of this record. But it just feels so warm. The saturated tones on it as well. And the fact that, yeah, there's some down moments, but there's also an awful lot of positivity on this record. It's a whole new approach, I think, not just since their earlier stuff, but even just since the previous album, since Automatic for the People. They toured this record, which was actually the first time since Green in the Green tour in 1989, as we mentioned. The support on the tour included Sonic Youth and Radiohead.
Yeah, and there's a Radiohead connection with a song, I Disappear. We'll come across it soon.
And actually, Michael Stipe and Tom York, I think, got pretty close at this point.
Yeah, they're good friends. How to Disappear Completely is inspired by Michael Stipe.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they actually worked on some stuff as well. I think there's some recordings of them singing on each other's songs live on tour that you can pick up in bootlegs. I'll take you over. Yeah, I'll take you over. Just like yeah, you. The first song in this, I need to give a little bit of my own history with it. What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
I fucking love this song.
It's a good song.
I fucking love this song. What's the Frequency, Kenneth? This y'all been so drained. So I picked this up on cassette when I was about 13. It must have been one of the earliest things I actually went and sought out. And, you know, 13 years old, that year was massive for me as a young music enthusiast trying to work out...
As a youth.
Trying to work out who I was. Kurt Cobain had died in April of that year. And actually, I've said this before, I remember the night he died, I was lying on the couch with a terrible migraine, channeling his blown apart head, I think. But I remember when that happened, and it was literally just months later that I nicked a copy of Nevermind and got ferociously into it instantly. Mm-hmm. Like, just freakishly, like sitting on my floor with my mouth open going, what the fuck? And my mum walking by going, what's that you're listening to? Mum doesn't talk like that, but she'd hate it if I did her actual voice. But by the end of the year, I was a huge Nirvana fan, only just realising what Cobain's death meant really, to the music scene and to that entire movement. And I wanted volume, but I also wanted hooks. And I think, to be honest, having tried it, but being pretty unmoved by metal, you know, Enter Sandman and all that shit, I'm like, whatever. I found a niche in the kind of grunge movement and that kind of alternative punk movement, and I was gorging on all those bands at a time when it was pretty well catered for. And that kind of brought me back to Monster, which I knew was there, but I revisited it in a bit more detail. I think What's the Frequency, Kenneth is very sweet natured. It's upbeat. It's sort of like a PG alt rock track of the era. God damn it, it's a really great song. It actually appeals to the same bit of me, I think, that really likes classic Weezer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got a lot in common with that. The real joy in just writing something fuzzy and good and pleasant. The saturated guitars were very distinct from the band's earlier stuff, obviously. The backwards guitar solo that's in it, I think,
I like that.
It showed that they were getting, again, a bit more inventive. We saw a bit of that on Try Not to Breathe in the last album. They've all got that sneaky "don't fuck with me" in the very last line. Cheeky boys, talking about glam credentials. Crush with Eyeliner, the second song. Another song I absolutely unironically love to this day. I loved the video at the time where they got a Japanese band to pretend to be them, which was great. The vibrato, for example, on that rolled off saturated Rickenbacker, very distinct in that tune. I think it just skirts the mainstream edge of grunge music really well. And okay, I acknowledge, and I said it earlier on, I think maybe it was slightly following the trends of the time. That might be a fair observation. It might be a fair critique of this album. Oh, grunge is in, and suddenly REM have gone from playing jangles to playing fuzzy guitars. But given how much those grunge bands owed to REM, and given the fact that REM had been consistently modifying their sound all the way, but especially from like Document onwards, it still doesn't seem all that contrived that they would do this. I mean, I take the perspective on board when people were critical of the band, but I think both are valid. I think it's hard to know how much of it was following and how much it was leading. But I do think what is very true is that REM tended, as I said, to push back against the spotlight. Not that they didn't want to be successful. I get there's a good argument against that coming up as well. But Automatic had gone for something, as I said, that would shake off the shiny happy fans, and then Automatic had exploded. This again felt like they were trying to shake off too much of that sort of beige mainstream attention for Automatic. And ironically, this also sold massively as well. So shaking off stuff wasn't really working. And I think that's largely just because the songs were really well written. I do acknowledge when I'm saying that they didn't try and court success, that the track Strange Currencies in particular flies in the face of that, because they basically re-released Everybody Hurts with that tune. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you mean to me, but I want to turn you out, figure you out. I want to take you on. So again, maybe they were just a wee bit conflicted. Who doesn't want to be big and celebrated? But at the same time, you get the feeling they didn't want to be tedious. I don't know. But there's a lot of variation on this.
I mean, quite like Bang and Blame.
Bang and Blame. It was his second single on this one after What's the Frequency. Do you know that Rain Phoenix does the backing vocals?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, because it was like River Phoenix's death, Michael Stipe and him were quite friendly, and that hit him quite hard. I think the third track on it, King of Comedy, just doesn't sound like R.E.M. Honestly, I think it's a really good song. It's very glam rock. I think Star 69 is like a beefier, trippier version of something that could have been on Fables or Life's Rich Pageant or one of those early albums. Funnily enough, Star 69 wasn't a single in this album, but it still got to number 74 in the charts, just because of the amount of people that phoned up radio stations asking for it. Strange Currencies, as I've said, it's another lullaby, and it's very probably something that makes this album better, but also a bit undermined. You know, I think people see it as just being schmaltzy and a bit corny. I think it's a great song. I really do. But I do also understand that it's a bit of an eye roll if you're not on board with it.
Yeah.
The track Tongue. I think it's a really interesting tune. It demonstrates a band miles away from where they started. The fact that he does like a kind of falsetto set against this, almost like a Motown tune, it shows that they're fucking about with stuff. It also contributes to that warmth of the album as well. And I mentioned it earlier on, I want to kind of dwell on Let Me In a wee bit, because Let Me In, the 10th track, is a big deal for me. It was a regular feature in my mixtapes at the time, which, by the way, are playlists for anybody born after 2001. It was written mid-sessions because the band had already done the first part of the sessions for Monster when Kurt Cobain committed suicide. So it was written pretty quickly. It was played on Kurt Cobain. I think it was the mint green Fender Jaguar that was given to Mike Mills. And actually, Mike Mills had to restring it because he's right-handed and Cobain was left-handed. And the track itself, written by Michael Stipe for Kurt Cobain, as we mentioned, River Phoenix also kind of featured in that kind of sense of loss for that period of writing. Minimal percussion on it, it's just a tambourine that shows up midway, but otherwise the whole tune is propelled by that ultra-saturated guitar bit of, I think it's a bit of like phaser that's going on in it as well. And Michael Stipe's vocal, plus there's an organ that appears in the latter half. I found it incredibly touching. I mean, there's different ways that song could have been executed, right? There's an alternate version on the 25th anniversary reissue of Monster, and it kind of dials back the guitar processing and it leaves the vocal naked. And that version certainly highlights how good Michael Stipe is in the studio, but I don't think it brings much else to the song. I just love that tender brutality of the album version. I mean, I'm using brutality in a very qualified sense here. We're talking about REM, not Nails. But, you know, they could have done this with a piano. They could have done it with an acoustic guitar. Mm. They could have done some, again, really maudlin, self-indulgent, melancholy thing. But they went for this big, saturated, ferocious, but tender thing. And I just think it's excellent. think it's an excellent way, and it sort of did justice to the subject matter. Yeah. Imagine Cobain loving that song. Mm-hmm. You think he really would have loved that song. The tour for the album itself, very successful. However, it was plagued with problems because, for example, during a 1995 show in Lausanne, Switzerland, Bill Berry collapsed on stage with a brain aneurysm, and Mike Mills and Michael Stipe both also had to go to hospital at various points for operations. That all said, the tour sold brilliantly, and I think it was actually inspired a bit by Radiohead. The band went on tour with an 8-track and got into the habit of recording sound checks and ideas backstage to try and capture some sort of like loose collection of demos, and that sort of grew arms and legs. Discussions began about, why don't we just actually record the album like this? Why don't we write the album on the road and then go and just capture it in its essence, live, using things like sound checks and live takes and things like that. And that led to New Adventures in Hi-Fi, which we're going to revisit in the final part of this in a bit more detail. But suffice to say, with New Adventures in Hi-Fi, they ended the mainstreaming with Bill second phase of REM. And thus, we arrived in REM phase three.
Yeah, there's not a lot to say here, if I'm totally honest.
Well, there isn't, right? It's a huge transition period, right? First of all, I would say that New Adventures in Hi-Fi was recorded prior to the departure of Jefferson Holt, the long-term manager, right? So he's gone. Mm-hmm. And then Bill Berry, he leaves for phase three. The boys had a brain aneurysm, fair enough. And he made sure, you know, if you guys are going to split up, I'm not going to go. But they were like, we're not going to split up, don't worry, Bill. You can go in good conscience. And then Scott Litt as well. He fell off the scene. They stopped recording with Scott Litt, which is significant because production becomes an issue. Mm-hmm. And Michael Stipe was quoted at the time as when Bill left, actually saying, are we still REM? I guess a three-legged dog is still a dog. It just has to learn to run differently. They became a trio. We hired guns. And we did mention that the caliber of those guns, see, that's a fucking... Mm-hmm. Good consistent metaphor there. Was pretty high. The Posies, Screaming Trees, Nine Inch Nails, Atoms for Peace. And and a new phase of songwriting was underway. It is interesting to note though that apparently the decision to transition to electronic stuff was already made. Mm-hmm. It wasn't because Bill left. Apparently that had been the chat. I don't know if perhaps Bill was like, my health's not good and I just don't fancy this era of drum machines. But certainly it was already something that the band had supposedly decided they were going to have a shot with. And bearing in mind that not long prior to this, bands like the Eels had sort of carved out a niche in like indie-tronica. Kind of similar to REM in some ways, but very different in the way that the records were arranged and delivered.
Had Peter Buck not already started buying like synthesizers and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think he had. He got quite into them, aye. Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's also worth noting that New Adventures in Hi-Fi sold about a third of Automatic for the People and about half as many as Monster. And despite the fact that it got to number two in the USA and it got to number one in the UK, it did represent a change in fortunes when you looked at the bottom line and their standing with the record label. Mm. Things were shifting. And that led to Up in 1998. And it's kind of hard to know what was expected of the record at the time. I mean, I was into REM and I really was struggling to remember how I felt in terms of anticipating this. They'd been the same band for, as I said, 17 years. Bill was a key songwriter. He was an anchor to that organic vibe that the band had, you know, the guitar, bass, drums thing. And likewise, losing Scott Litt was unavoidably going to have an impact on how they came across on record. That era heralded the potential for stuff to be quite abstract, I think, like for them to move in different directions, reflecting what was the zeitgeist at the time. Indietronica was a big one. When you listen to it, Up, it's a departure, that's for sure. Airport Man, the first track on it, is very understated.
Yeah.
honestly, it's just kind of a confusing opening. But you've got to say the band no doubt spent a lot of time on the track order and that decision. And I suppose from that you can only infer that they were making clear that they were not out to try and win everybody back with some big slutty pop banger, you know, on track one of this new album. They were going to do it on their terms. The second track, Lotus, was their reasonably decent-sized single, I guess, at the time, in a very 90s sort of way. I mean, I think it kind of sounds like a much better version of Top Loader, ultimately, with that piano sound. So here's the thing, I mean, let's just be clear, this album is a bit pastel and a bit bland, which was maybe to be expected a wee bit, but I will say in its defence, it has a definite vibe, and if you can make peace with that, it's actually tonally really consistent, and that's something that I think Out of Time and maybe even Automatic for the People were not. They were quite erratic albums from song to song, whereas I think Up actually flows pretty well. It stays within its lanes quite well.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, the fourth track, Hope, makes some nice use of the new electronic angle. It's pretty unpretentious, but it's a little riff on a drum machine loop and some synths, and it's not a wild song, but it's quite likable. The fifth one, At My Most Beautiful,
it's a good song.
That was a single. It's fine, you know.
It's got the blushness of like Brian's Beach Boys orchestration.
It sounds very Beach Boys, doesn't it? It's okay. The Apologist, I mean, I think I would have liked to have heard The Apologist to a band that still included Bill, played as a guitar-based drums band. I wanted to apologise for everything I was. So, I'm sorry, so sorry, so sorry. The recording is very robotic and it lacks a kind of organic quality, although the chorus is a beautiful lift in that one. I think that the standout track in this album for me was Walk Unafraid. This is another track that my band messed around with back in the day. Colin, who'll be listening, the guitarist, was a huge REM fan, to the extent of buying blouses with big floral cuffs and waistcoats and really modelling himself on Peter Buck. I think Walking Afraid's a brilliant song. I think it's got that whole pessimistic energy that made the best REM singles, basically. It's a shame that it arrived out with the original band era, because I think on the record it's kind of a wash with synths, and they're not bad synths, but it sounds a bit overproduced. Are they REM? I don't know if they are. It's a tune that certainly works better live. There's a collection, they've got a lot of live collections, let's be clear, but the German Broadcast collection from 2001 has a particularly good version of this. It really benefits with the extra BPM as well. And then track 11, Day Sleeper. I see today with the newsprint, gray, my night is colored. Had a great day sleeper. Day sleeper. From a personal perspective, this is actually quite a significant track for me. Mm-hmm. It's very vintage REM, I think.
I like that song.
And it could have been on any of the previous four records from Green onwards. It's got a very different production feel, and it harkens back a lot for me because I got this cassette for my birthday 1 year. And I'll be honest, my family were pretty broke at the time, right? So I'm about, 17, something like that. Not a lot of money kicking about. I get this cassette on my birthday. It's a cassette single. You know, it's a very modest birthday. But I have to say, like, I rinsed that tape. Mm-hmm. Like, I really rinsed it. I played it a lot. So I have quite a lot of affection for that tune.
Mm-hmm.
It's furious balancing. I'm the screen, the blinding light. I'm the screen, I work at night. I see the day with the...
And it's probably one of the outliers on that record. But I do think, as I said, I don't feel particularly invested in that album. Yeah. That's probably the word I would use. Mm-hmm. But I do think it is one of the most tonally consistent, certainly since their very, very early days.
Mm-hmm.
But it really sounds like it was all done at the same time with similar things in mind.
Yeah.
And they followed that in 1989, quickly, with Man on the Moon. The Andy Kaufman biopic came out and they had one of the main songs in it. Obviously, it was named after their track. But they brought out The Great Beyond, which is a pretty strong single, actually. It caused a stir at the time. I was really pleased to hear it. It felt a bit more authentically REM.
Mm-hmm.
And then Reveal came out in 2001. Now, hot take. This is a very, very underrated record.
Mm.
And I would say that proportionally speaking, and this does not mean this is my favourite record, but proportionally speaking, this is their most underrated by dint of how harshly it's criticised compared to how it actually is, in my opinion. I think this would have been a very thorny but defensible choice for the show. It was actually critically well received at the time, but in retrospect has fared very, very poorly. It tanks in the rankings, and I'll go into some of the rankings shortly, but I mean, it's just abysmal in the rankings, to the extent that I actually thought I'd somehow mixed it up with one of their other albums in my head, and I had to go back and double check. I was kind of gaslighting myself. For me, this record shows that the band had settled in to the kind of post-drummer period. They were doing a lot of stuff electronically. Yeah, there's drums on it, but they were writing as a trio. The studio on it is still much more apparent than in the Scotlit stuff, but it felt a bit more natural than on Up. Pound for pound, I think the songs on here are as good as many of their albums. Are people just madly against the polished sound, or the fact that it was kind of like a little bit pedestrian, because let's be honest, they were getting a bit old and a bit passé? I think they sort of became a slight middle-aged eye roll just because people hadn't been about for them, and they were like, who are these old guys?
Mm-hmm.
Fuck this. And it's just not cool, and cool's such an unquantifiable and ephemeral thing, but it just wasn't a cool album. They weren't a cool band at a cool stage of anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what the fuck was going on here? Like 2001, new metal, mm-hmm. right? So it's like, they were just anachronistic. Mm-hmm. But actually, I think it's pretty decent. Funny thing, I'm saying all those things about cool, but I should caveat that by saying Accelerate probably did do better than it, even though it came out later. But anyway, in terms of the tracks, very quickly, The Lifting, the opening track, I think it's just a nice tune. Once I know. The electronics are used really well. It's got some really nice hooks and some really nice melodic changes in it. Never see, never dream. I think the track All the Way to Reno, it's a bit lethargic at the BPM that it has on the album, but it's not a bad song, and it's good live. Fastened on your sleeve. You know what you are. You're gonna be a star. I think the track Disappear.
Disappear. That's the one that's so. Tom York was inspired by Michael Stipe, hence why he wrote How to Disappear Completely, because that's what he felt as though he had to try and do live, because his stage fright, How to Disappear Completely in front of people.
It's a beautiful song.
Yeah, so Disappear,
it's got a shanty vibe to it.
Yeah, Disappear is like his response to that song. Tom York had told him he'd written that because Michael Stipe had told him that's kind of what he tries to do live, and he was like, well, here's my version of the same kind of idea.
I looked for you everywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there he was gyrating in the middle of the stage.
It's interesting, it's a really rich song. It's quite a grand sounding song.
It is, man, you know? It is. I think the chord changes in the chorus are great. I mean, I think the song works great. I think the production sort of smothers it a wee bit, but I think it's a really nice bit of music. And I could have heard it back on the Green kind of era, or maybe like Out of Time, around about like Half a World Away. It's got something in common with that kind of thing.
It's a little touch of electronics in it as well.
Yeah.
Just a little touch, which I think is probably a Radiohead thing.
Yeah. And how well REM handled electronics is up for debate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are definitely a few tunes on here that are totally pointless. I mean, Beat a Drum, Summer Turns to High, fucking pointless songs.
Imitation of Life is a huge single for them.
Imitation of Life is a good single, yeah.
Really good song.
It's right back to peak Out of Time era
REM.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It really sounds like that. The production isn't as good as that. It isn't as fresh and as energetic, but musically the writing is back there. Maybe it tries to ape it too closely, in fact. Maybe that's part of the problem. I don't know, but I think it's a good song by their standards. And I also think, and it's a guilty pleasure if there is such a thing, but I'll Take the Rain.
Mm-hmm.
After a couple of filler tunes that precede it, this is a really strong penultimate track. Okay, it starts pretty unremarkably, but it builds really well. It's got some proper gushy sentiments in it that just get me in the feels, like they really do. And some great dramatic sweeps. You know, you put this song on a record of theirs again around about 1991 and tell me it doesn't become like a fan favourite. You know, I think it's a really pretty, gentle, likeable bit of music. So yeah, I mean, I think that album's appraised very, very harshly. It was followed by In Time, the best of, a really good collection of best ofs actually, 2003. Barring the omission maybe of stuff like Monty Got a Raw Deal and some of the other great album tracks like Pretty Persuasion and stuff that we've talked about, it's really strong. It also includes a single, Bad Day, which I think is actually a really strong bit of classic
R&B. It's a really good song.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Really think they nailed it on that one. It was a good way to sell that collection. Yeah, and then 2004, Around the Sun, and I have very little to say about this because at this point in my life, I had moved past REM. You might have laughed if I told you. You might have hidden your frown.
You might have succeeded in changing me. Peter Buck says, this just wasn't really listenable because it sounds like what it is, a bunch of people that are so bored with the material that they can't stand it anymore.
Yeah, it fares very, very badly on lists. I mean, in terms of the tracks, I do think the first one, Leaving New York, is competent. It's sweet. It's got a pleasant chorus, you know, departure and loss. It's melancholy, but it's also pretty cheesy. But, you know, cheesy and REM did become kind of synonymous at a certain point. I don't know. It's the sort of song you can imagine being at like a Glasgow Green show and a bunch of middle-aged people putting their arms around each other's shoulders and swaying to it. It's that kind of tune. Electron Blues reminds me of some very bland Placebo from the later era. The Outsiders, Jesus fucking Christ, fucking Q-Tip.
Q-Tip, yeah.
Throwing some hip-hop into the mix, because hip-hop worked so well on the previous stuff, didn't it? A man walks away when every muscle says to stay. How many yesterdays, they each weigh heavy. Who says what changes may come? Who says what we call home? I know you see right through me, my luminescence fades. The dust provides an antidote. And I mean, just to shame it, the seventh track, Wanderlust, is just stinking. This is very clearly not the bubbly misfit jangle punk in 1982, but it's maybe not fair to critique it on that basis, right? But yeah, let's just forget about it.
So the next record is Accelerate, right?
Yep, Accelerate, 2008.
So Peter Buck said that personally he hated Around the Sun. Well, hated is too hard. I hated the fact it wasn't as good as it should have been. And he even said that Michael Stipe was going, you know, if you make another bad record, it's over.
Yeah.
And then they made it, then that's when they were making Accelerate. They're like, it's got to be a good record.
Yeah.
I guess it remains to be seen if it's a good record by IDM standards, but it is certainly a unique record by their standards.
It's a much, much better record.
Yeah, for sure.
I didn't really engage with it at the time, but it seems to have been a bit of a return to form, certainly critically. Going back to it now, I think it seems obvious that the title, for example, is a nod to the fact that the band just had to fucking speed up and kick things back up a gear.
And they did it fast as well. They did the record quickly as well. They recorded it really quickly. They mixed it in 10 days.
Not getting caught up in the studio with all the techniques and overproduction.
Stipe said, we spent less time making this record than we have in 20 years.
Yeah. Colin, listener to the show, good friend of mine, bandmate from back in the day, he was supplying me with all the inside info because he stuck with them. And Colin tells me that they workshopped these tunes in a wee venue in Dublin in the form of live rehearsals to a limited audience before going back into the studio. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like as a proxy for touring, effectively. You go on tour, you try workshopping your new songs, see what goes over, see what doesn't go over. They actually ended up releasing some of the highlights of those sessions on a collection called 39 Songs, Live at the Olympia, Dublin. Mm-hmm. It's good. It's worth listening to, actually. And also Peter Buck just dingied all the synths.
Yeah.
Got the axes back at the cupboard.
Yeah.
And that really helped. It seems like it maybe this album took one giant effort to recapture some of that youthful energy.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, debatably, that last big effort used up the last of that energy. And yeah, the album does occasionally stray into Counting Crows, but I guess that's what happens when older guys, you know, they're trying to gun it one more time.
Mm-hmm.
The first track, Living Well's The Best Revenge, is a fairly killer opening tune.
Yeah, it's a good song.
I don't think many people saw like a high tempo belter kicking things off, given what had gone before. And it does seem to be a band sort of shaking themselves out of a daze, you know? I mean, it lacks that sort of brilliant, open, spacious, energetic Scott Litt production. Again, it's a track that I would have loved to have heard with the classic lineup back in maybe the Say the Monster era. You can actually hear it on their 2009 collection, Live at the Olympia, and it sounds great. It's a better version, actually, than the album version. They were still clearly capable of writing good tunes. The third one in that, Supernatural, Super Serious. Everybody here comes from somewhere that they would just as soon forget.
That's a good song. I like that as
that, well. It doesn't sound like it, but it reminded me of Beverly Hills by Weezer, mm-hmm. in the sense that it's just something fun.
And yeah, it's so big and bombastic.
Exactly,
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, otherwise, I'm not massively au fait with that album, but I do know that it's, you know, it's probably one that's going to age better, certainly, mm-hmm. than the likes of Up and yeah. Reveal seem to have.
Yes.
And then their final album, Collapse Into Now, from 2011, this one song, apparently, according to the knowledgeable Colin, the band knew it would be their last when they recorded it, but they hadn't actually announced that.
Yeah, their deal with Warner Bros. Was coming to an end.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. they just had no intention of really continuing. As much as I concede that they stayed beyond their best, I think it's mercifully short overhang, if you know what mm. I mean. There are plenty of bands out there that have released a lot more records beyond their creative peak.
Yeah.
And I think REM's third phase records do have some great tunes in them. You know, hot take, perhaps as many great tunes as their first phase. Mm. Is that controversial?
I don't think so.
But I would say that the performance and the energy, for obvious reasons, is not the equal of the first phase.
Mm. You want to know some of this studio discussion around this record?
Go for it.
So they wanted to make some decisions about going forward, and they thought, well, they all independently arrived at the conclusion that this was a chance to go out on a high. Buck said that the final decision to end the band came when Michael Stipe remarked that I need to be away from this for a long time, and then Buck just suggested, how about forever? And that's they decided to break up.
Wow. You can't tell if that's passive aggressive or just like really frank.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they've been friends for so long, it probably was just like, well, how about just forever? And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the record's pretty stodgy. I've never heard it all the way
through. They feel alive, right? They feel alive in this record, but the songs just aren't there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I tried to go back to back, but I couldn't get there. There's some fuzzy rock stuff on it. It's decent. It doesn't go for that lo-fi indie-tronica thing that they did on Up, but there are better fuzzy tunes on the likes of Monster by far. And the fourth track in it, Oh My Heart, I think it's nice. It's a bit of a highlight. This place is the beat of my heart. Oh my heart. Oh my heart. It references Out of Time Automatic kind of period, you know, in the folkiness, and you know, accordions and 3/3 timings with this band, they're friends, and so you can't really go wrong. But other than that, it kind of passed me by. And yeah, and I guess just to conclude their back catalogue, I did a wee dig into what are other people saying. A few of the websites that we like to go to, louder.com, Around the Sun, Dead Last. Mm-hmm. Consequence.net, Around the Sun, Dead Last. Vinyl Mapper, Around the Sun, Dead Last. Stereo Gum, Around the Sun, Dead Last. And Rate Your Music, Reveal, Dead Last. Fuck off. What? That's fucking ridiculous, man. Anyway, so louder.com had put Reveal at 11 out of 15. Other places it made 14 out of 15, 11 out of 15, 15 out of 16. I mean, I don't understand why Reveal's taking so much fucking dog's abuse. I think Reveal is a far better album than that, but, well, what the fuck do I know? Things like Out of Time, that was coming in at like number 8 on a lot of lists. Document was at number 2 for Louder. Automatic was at number 1 a couple of times. It was at number 3. What was interesting was that New Adventures almost always came in the top 5. Mm-hmm. 6 on one list, I think, but otherwise 5, 4, 3. Never 2 or 1, but always in and around then. And that's why I made that kind of hot take point of maybe Reveal is proportionally more underrated. Mm-hmm. It's far worse, but it's so dismissed that I'm like, come on.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely lambasted. And I'm mm-hmm. like, it's not that fucking bad. Mm-hmm. Like, that bit I just don't get. But yeah, I mean, to conclude this part of the show, the third era of REM, I think people interested in hearing later REM stuff are probably much better served listening to some of the numerous official live records, because REM's later stuff especially massively benefits from being played live. It massively benefits for real drums, for starters, but they just tend to play it a bit faster. Michael's performances are more juiced up. It's good. Mm-hmm. It's a good way to hear them, and it's the only way to give them a fair hearing as songs. Yeah, I don't think the studio was REM's friend post Scotlet. I'll just be honest. I think they laboured in the studio. They got too into the weeds of things, and it all became a little bit mulchy, and it lacked that. Like you said, when they mixed faster, it seemed to help. Accelerate seems to benefit from that. So yeah, I think that last period's kind of characterised by that as well. And unfortunately for those last records, some of the songwriting I would suggest is good. It does not get to live up to its potential on the albums. So go and try and find it on a live record. And that brings us back to our choice record, which we're going to visit in side D of this double vinyl gatefold edition of REM with floppy disk included. Mm-hmm. And we will get to that next time.
Yes.
What say you of their back catalogue, Mark? To summarise,
it's just, when they're good, they're really good, but for the most part, over the piece, they're not often that good. You know, like, they've got more shit records than good consistent records.
Yeah.
But that's a feature of any band that's been going for ages. I don't think there's any band that's been going for a long time that you can say, if you can get three records back to back, and you've been going for, if you get 15 records and you manage to get three back to back, then that's brilliant. That's exactly what you want.
Yeah.
Very rarely do bands that have a lot of records get to that. I mean, try to think of some of the bands that are like Iron Maiden did three records back to back that were pretty good, but they've got like, I think, almost 20 or something now, and they're mostly pish.
So you're talking about painful past episodes of research. That was one of them for me.
Yeah. Slayer have got maybe three consistently good records back to back, and a couple of other decent ones throughout. You know, REM just seem to hit the stride when they hit a major label and decide to stop touring. You know, yeah, that's when they really hit their stride. They had three good records back to back, technically four if you want to add in Monster.
Do you think that longevity that the band enjoyed was partly due to that decision not to tour at the peak of their career, when things could have become so fucking overwhelming?
Possibly. I think they've probably seen it coming after Green, you know. They probably got a taste of it with This End of the World As We Know and stuff like that,
yeah,
before they were on a major, and made a smart decision just to not.
It's a really interesting decision in hindsight, and it may be the thing that stopped them becoming the cautionary tale of the past.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll come back and we'll dive into the main event, which is New Adventures in Hi-Fi in the next episode.
Let's go.